Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to be hosting this FedSoc Forum called 20 Years Later, Kelo versus City of New London. We're very pleased to welcome our excellent speakers to this discussion today, Professor Peter Byrne, Wesley Horton, Timothy Sandifer, and Professor Ilya Soman. And special thanks to Professor Eric Clay for moderating this event. Eric is a professor of law at the George Mason University Antonin Scalia Law School. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. And at the end of the program, we will turn to the audience for questions. So if you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. And finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Eric, thanks so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Edie, thank you again for having me. By previous arrangement, I'm going to talk a little bit just to give the background of the Kelo case, and then I'll introduce each of the panelists as they're going to speak, and each of them is going to talk for 7 or 8 minutes, and then we'll have one go around for people, each of the speakers, to make a couple of points in a couple of minutes in response to what other speakers have said, and then we'll go to the audience. So this webinar looks back on the U.S. Supreme Court decision, Kelo versus City of New London, handed down 20 years ago this week. Kelo involved what are sometimes called private-to-private transfers. In a private-to-private transfer, a government condemns private property using the eminent domain power, but the government does not hold on to the property as it would land for a government road or a government building. Instead, the government passes on the condemned land to another private party. In Kelo, the City of New London, Connecticut, sponsored a private-to-private transfer, and it argued the transfer was likely to contribute to local economic development, and it argued that that development made the taking for public use. The condemnees argued that the transfer violated the U.S. Constitution, and particularly the public use clause of the U.S. Constitution's Fifth Amendment. By a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court upheld the New London Project from constitutional challenge. It held that the public use clause does not stop private-to-private transfers in certain conditions I'll mention in a minute. The project at issue in Kelo came about after New London and Connecticut state leaders persuaded officials of Pfizer, the pharmaceutical company, to build facilities in New London. New London officials hoped that the new Pfizer buildings would draw new business to the New London area and revitalize the city. City and state leaders planned to redevelop 90 acres near the new Pfizer construction for a waterfront conference hotel, an urban village, a river walk, new residences, a new museum, new office space, and new retail stores and parking areas. Among the other neighborhoods targeted for redevelopment was a residential neighborhood inhabited by Suzette Kelo and 8 other petitioners at the Supreme Court, and those 9 petitioners owned 15 lots in the neighborhood. While litigation was going on, New London authorities were planning to transfer title to the land to a commercial developer based out of Boston on a 99-year ground lease. So Kelo and the other petitioners challenged the constitutionality of the project, and particularly the part of the project that was going to condemn their lots and transfer them over to the commercial developer. And again, a 5-vote majority of the Supreme Court held that this was a constitutional exercise of state power. In New London, there was no violation of the public use clause. And the Supreme Court opinion written by Justice Stevens held that the public use clause does not stop private to private transfers as long as the condemning government prepares a comprehensive development plan, as long as that plan finds that the transfer will indeed promote local economic development, and that there's no evidence that the condemning government is condemning on a pretext to favor local companies without any genuine public use. Justice Kennedy wrote a sole sole written concurrence. And he argued in particular to stress that he would not have joined the opinion or he would oppose expanding Kelo further if there was evidence that a purported public use, a purported finding that the redevelopment project would promote economic development was pretextual, that it was there were only pretextual public benefits. Justice O'Connor wrote a dissent for herself and for Justice Scalia and Chief Justice Rehnquist. She argued that the Kelo decision and its finding that there was a public use went beyond any other precedent that the Supreme Court had handed down, saying that a private transfer was still a taking for a public use. And she authored this memorable passage. I'm going to read from it. That the specter of after the case, the specter of condemnation hangs over all property. Nothing is to prevent the state from replacing any Motel 6 with a real Ritz-Carlton, any home with a shopping mall, or any farm with a factory. Justice Thomas wrote a dissent for himself. He read the phrase public use to mean that after a taking, the property that was condemned must be used by the public. And he argued that all of the Supreme Court's cases on private to private transfers going back 110 years were wrong and should be overturned. So that's a quick synopsis on what Kelo did. And we're pleased to have four very distinguished experts to help us look back on Kelo. The first of those is Wesley Horton. Wesley's of counsel to the Connecticut Law Partnership, McElroy, Deutsch, Mulvaney, and Carpenter. He's a practicing appellate lawyer. He's argued more than 135 cases at the Connecticut Supreme Court, and he argued Kelo on behalf of the city of New London in the U.S. Supreme Court, and he won it. And so, Wesley, the floor, thank you for coming, and the floor is yours.
Good. Thank you. First of all, you're going to hear from two professors, and they're going to talk about constitutional theory, and they're going to talk about public policy. I'm an appellate advocate. My job is to talk about five votes. How do you get five votes? And the interesting thing is that about getting five votes is the tactical decisions that lawyers make on appeal has a great effect, not only on the Supreme Court's decision and did in the Kelo case, but also has a great effect on the public reaction to the decision. The first thing an appellate lawyer does is say, who's in play on the Supreme Court? And in the Kelo case, there are only two people. It was Justice O'Connor and Justice Kennedy. From the plaintiff side, they had to assume that the three conservative justices, Rehnquist, Scalia, and Thomas, were on their side, or their case was hopeless. On my side, I had to assume the four liberals on the court were on my side, or my case was hopeless. Now, the two justices in play were the least ideological members of the court, and they were perhaps the most cautious members of the court. Now, that makes a big difference tactically in how you run things. For example, the plaintiff did not attack the principal decision in this case, which is Berman versus Parker, which is a 1954 case that permitted the use of eminent domain to eliminate blight. But the problem for the plaintiffs was that Mr. Berman's property was not blighted, number one. And number two, the language in Berman was much broader than just talking about blight. But nevertheless, the plaintiffs made the tactical decision not to ask that Berman be overruled, which probably was a good tactical decision to make in terms of the two justices that were in play, but simply said, that's a case about blight. And consequently, when you read the Supreme Court's decision, one side says that's distinguishable and the other side says it's not distinguishable. And fortunately, I had five votes that said it was not distinguishable. But that was to some extent because of the tactical decisions of the parties. The second tactical decision is the plaintiff was represented by the Institute for Justice, which had been gunning for overruling Kelo for some time and obviously thought that this was the ideal case to shoot for the moon. They had on their side in the Connecticut Supreme Court, three dissenting justices who said, it is a public use, what was being done here, but there should be a higher test, and the city did not meet that test. But they minimized that because tactically they figured this was the case to go all the way. And because they made that tactical decision, for the opposition said, why do I want to give the Supreme Court an opportunity to give them a win? Because any reversal would have been a win for them, with a higher test. So I simply minimized this Supreme Court dissenting, Connecticut Supreme Court dissenting opinion, and it was very little discussed by the Supreme Court, this backup argument. And even today, the Kelo opponents are talking about just overruling Kelo, not talking about whether there should be some higher test having to do with private economic development plans. And that was very much a tactical decision that the lawyers had made in the case. The third point is both Justice O'Connor and Justice Kennedy, being the least ideological members of the court, are interested in talking about facts. And therefore, I wanted to talk about facts. How do I go about talking about facts and getting their attention? This is a Supreme Court, after all, that isn't going to want to spend the whole argument talking about facts if they can avoid it. And so I sat back looking at the ceiling, wondering, what do I do? And I said, I have an idea. I'm going to hold up the chart and, use it as a prop. And now that should get their attention about the facts. So I called the Supreme Court clerk and I said, can I do this? And they said, well, the last time it was done was in the 1970s when somebody held up a dead fish and the Chief Justice said, get that snail darter out of the courtroom right now. But he said, if you want to take your chance, just blow it up. Give us send down 9 copies. So I did, and I brought the prop with me, waiting for an opportunity to hold it up in front of the justices. But talking about facts, before I get there, you have a downside about talking about facts. And that's, you're going to get hypothetical questions from hostile justices like Justice Scalia, who could tie me up for 10 minutes with what about this fact? What about that hypothetical? And then going all the way down to the bottom of the slippery slope, which was, can you condemn a Motel 6 to give it to a Ritz-Carlton because it's going to pay more taxes? And I tried that in the moot and said, no, that's going too far. And ended up 10 minutes later, I didn't have an answer for where the line was, and it was a mess. So I said, Justice Scalia is going to eat me alive. I can't very well answer a question about Motel 6 by saying, that's irrelevant, Your Honor, because that's nowhere near the line. So it doesn't make any difference where the line is. I'd be thrown out of the courtroom if I gave that answer. So the only other possibility was say, yes, that was okay. And in fact, Justice O'Connor asked me that precise question about a Motel 6 and a Ritz-Carlton. I said, yes, that will be proper. And because I was way down at the bottom of the slippery slope, there were no more hypotheticals to bother me. And I just waited for a chance to hold up my chart. And Justice O'Connor accommodated and said, well, tell us about the facts. And I held up my chart in front of the justices. And I'm looking at the transcript afterwards. I spoke for 41 lines of transcript. And if you think that's not very long, read it out to yourself and imagine 9 justices sitting there saying not a word, except for Justice O'Connor asked 2 questions about the chart asking where the plaintiff's property was, without Justice Scalia saying a word of interruption in the thing. Now, did what I do make any difference? Well, what we know is the 5th vote was not from Justice O'Connor, but was from Justice Kennedy, and he focused on the facts of the case, especially the fact that the developer had not been chosen at the time, at the original time. It played into the hand of the Justice Kennedy, who said things like this were okay as long as it wasn't some pretext like trying to support some developer. So I can't tell you it made a difference, but I'll tell you one place it did make a difference. It made a difference in the public opinion, because the public opinion afterwards, the opponents could cite what I said, yes, to the Motel 6 hypothetical, and the fact whether my client ever would have done that didn't make any difference. The fact is, I said that, and I said it for a tactical reason, and it obviously had an effect. Now, the last point I want to make is, it seems to me the Federalist Society should have been my side, at least, even if everybody else is against me, because what my position did was make the states the final word in this subject.
Thank you, Wes. Our next speaker is Timothy Sandifer. He's the Vice President for Legal Affairs, and he holds the Duncan Chair in Constitutional Government at the Scharf Norton Center for Constitutional Litigation. He litigates to promote economic liberty, private property, free speech, and other crucial values in states across the country. He's the author of 8 books, most recently Freedom's Furies, How Isabel Patterson, Rose Wilder Lane, and Ayn Rand Found Liberty in an Age of Darkness. Timothy.
Thanks so much, Eric. So Kelo is the most obviously and egregiously wrongly decided opinion that most people can think of. It was wrongly decided on basically any constitutional interpretive theory that you apply. It was wrong on originalist grounds because there's no question that the authors of the Constitution would have been horrified by the idea that the government can take away a person's home and hand it over to a private developer to build luxury condominiums on it. It's wrong on a textual approach. Because if the term for public use means anything at all, it means not for private use. And yet the court's application of the rational basis standard here basically eviscerates that distinction, so that there is virtually nothing. I would take out the word virtually. There is nothing I can think of that would not be arguably an acceptable use of eminent domain under the theory adopted in Kelo. And it's wrongly decided on a just a pure policy living constitutional approach, because of course it constitutionally guarantees open season on private property for the benefit of government planners who think they know better than consumers and producers do who should prevail in the marketplace, which of course opens the door to moral hazard and public choice problems that allow the powerful lobbyists to come in, and like Costco to come in and ask for neighborhoods to be demolished and replaced with expensive shopping centers. The Kelo case is, I should say, I mentioned Costco. The Kelo case is a little bit misleading in that the most common victim of eminent domain abuse is not homes. It's usually small businesses, because homes usually aren't located in the kind of areas that government planners target for eminent domain for industrial development. So we're talking about the typical victim of eminent domain. We're talking about a small business owner. And thanks to the rational basis test, the small business owner is essentially forced to go to court to prove that there is no rational way that it could possibly benefit anybody in a public sense, in any length of time or in any way, for the government to come and take his property. That is, it forces him to prove a negative, to disprove every conceivable rational basis for the condemnation. Under a test that the Supreme Court has said, facts are constitutionally irrelevant. That's the phrase from FCC versus Beach Communications. So, of course, what Kelo effectively does is it declares that your property is presumptively already the government's property. The question is just when is the government going to go about declaring that it has a better use for your property than you do? And that's objectionable on moral, constitutional, and purely legal grounds. The reason why Kelo came out the way it did, however, is kind of the reason why Kelo became such an important symbol and why it remains such an important symbol. And that is because it is really the perfect encapsulation of the consequence of the post-New Deal settlement, as the lawyers like to call it, in constitutional law. The post-New Deal settlement is the theory that some rights deserve protection and other rights don't. That is, that property, which is the one right that is most frequently mentioned in the Constitution more than any other right, it's mentioned 4 or 5 different ways in the Bill of Rights, whereas religion is mentioned once, for example, that this right is really not fundamental, really not all that important, and therefore it can be trusted to the democratic process to decide who gets to keep and use their property and why and how and so forth. And that courts should engage in judicial restraint. The term judicial restraint, of course, is a progressive notion that says that when the government violates your rights, courts should do nothing about it. They should stand back and say, nah, whatever. That's judicial restraint. And Kelo is a perfect monument to judicial restraint, as are cases such as Plessy versus Ferguson and Korematsu versus United States, in which the government, again, decided to deprive people of their fundamental rights. And the court said, nah, you know, whatever. Let the political process decide. And that's basically what the court did to private property in Kelo. Now, one thing Mr. Horton said that is absolutely correct is that the Kelo case tossed the question to the states and said, OK, in fact, Justice Stevens in the concluding paragraph paragraph says it's up to states to decide if they want to put more stringent protections for private property rights into place. And in reaction to the Kelo decision 20 years ago, we saw a wave of efforts to reform state laws to prevent the abuse of eminent domain for private use. Most of them, I'm sorry to say, in my estimation, were not very effective. Mostly they were window dressing designed by politicians to look like they were doing something without actually doing anything, like blue ribbon commissions to assess the problem and write a report that nobody reads and nobody does anything about. But I'm glad to say that here in my home state of Arizona, we've adopted some very effective reforms here at the Goldwater Institute and our friends over at the Institute for Justice. We worked together to draft a ballot initiative, the Arizona Private Property Rights Protection Act, which prevents the use of eminent domain for private use. Of course, the Arizona Constitution already explicitly says cannot take property for private use. So this puts teeth into that as a statutory matter by saying not only can the government not take your property for private economic development purposes, but it also cannot restrict your use of your private property in ways that deprive you of the value of your property. And then when the government does so, it must either compensate you, or if it chooses, it can decide not to impose that restriction on your property. And in the 20 years since that law has been in place, Arizona has experienced a remarkable success in eminent domain reform. Now, opponents, of course, they complain that if this thing were adopted, my goodness, you know, the sky would fall and dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria, and so forth. None of that happened, although some of our friendly opponents here in Phoenix like to say it created, this is a direct quote, it created a chilling effect for government regulation of private property. Yeah, that's a feature, not a bug. So if anybody out there is interested in learning more about Arizona's Private Property Rights Protection Act, you can check it out on our website. We have some reports that analyze how it went. And I want to end that in here on an up note, because what Prop 27 shows, and in fact, what Kelo itself shows, is that there is still a lot of belief in the sanctity of private property rights, and that it is wrong for the government to take somebody's stuff away and give it to somebody else simply because politicians think that that will somehow benefit the public. And the Kelo decision, in that sense, can be seen in a glass half full way. Mr. Horton mentioned Berman versus Parker. There were a couple other cases like Hawaii Housing versus Midkiff and other eminent domain and property rights cases, which always came out unanimously bad for property owners, declared that the public use clause of the Fifth Amendment was basically meaningless. And Kelo was the first time a Supreme Court justice had ever declared that a taking through eminent domain violated the public use clause. And in fact, four justices said that. That's one away from a majority. That one, by the way, being Justice Kennedy, his opinion is very interesting for some more sophisticated reasons about what rational basis means and all that, that perhaps we can get into in the question and answer period.
Thank you, Timothy. Our next speaker is J. Peter Byrne. He's the John Hampton Baumgartner Jr. Professor of Real Property Law at Georgetown Law School. He's the faculty director of Georgetown's Environmental Law and Policy Program and also of its Climate Change Center. He's the co-author with Sarah Bronin of Historic Preservation Law. Peter, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Eric. And it's a pleasure to be invited to participate in this 20th anniversary of the Kelo case. In addition to being a professor, I co-authored an amicus brief in the case for the National League of Cities. It feels a trifle ironic that what seemed like a very hot and central constitutional issue 20 years ago rather pales in light of the nonstop constitutional crises that we've been grounding in, threatening basic rights of due process, the separation of powers, and perhaps even the rule of law itself. But we should all work in the hope that eventually we'll return to a legal culture in which we stay awake at night worrying about the scope of the public use clause. So the central question here really is whether or on what basis a federal court can constrain state and local governments from choosing to use eminent domain as part of an urban regeneration plan. As Justice Stevens noted from the record in Kelo, there was no question that New London was a distressed city and that the use of eminent domain had been approved by the state, which essentially provided the money, and elected local officials in New London. Moreover, part of the dispute is whether the government can cooperate with private capital in the redevelopment. Now, Connecticut and New London chose to do so. They created an adjacent state park, and they also created a private nonprofit corporation, the London Development Corporation, to manage the project. The Supreme Court ultimately described the New London Development Corporation as the city's development agent. So private involvement in the case is, you know, shaded between public and private. Now, the focus of the constitutional argument has to do with the phrase, we all know, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. The Institute for Justice and some of the dissenters in the case want to argue that use must connote either the elimination of deplorable physical conditions, which generally referred to as blight, or to require public ownership or ownership by a so-called common carrier, whereby the public has some right to use the acquired land as by purchasing electricity from a transmitted across it. But the Supreme Court has never adopted either argument, and indeed has squarely rejected it unanimously more than once. As Tim said, Skilo was the first case in which any justices suggested that might be the rule, the proper interpretation of public use. Now, the Fifth Amendment clearly commands that just compensation be paid for any expropriation, but does not clearly restrict when government can use expropriation. It hardly takes linguistic acrobatics to understand that the government can use a taking to induce a private developer to build structures that the government wants to be built in order to advance what the government considers to be important public interests. Indeed, in the unanimous decision in Berman versus Parker, the court held that the term public use is coterminous with the legislative power. And of course, eminent domain is a legislative power fundamentally. So this is a constitutional position that I accept, although I am in the camp that believes that due process analysis in these circumstances should involve something more than minimal scrutiny or rubber stamping. And indeed, I think in this case, both Justice Stevens and Justice Kennedy look for indicia to show that there truly was an important public purpose being carried out and that the project had been fully vetted by the political process. Now, it doesn't mean that I think that the use of eminent domain should be a frequent tool for economic redevelopment. The record on the use of it is very mixed, and there are certainly some disastrous cases. And as an ardent historic preservationist, I greatly prefer incremental incentive-based programs to redevelop using the historic and cultural assets of a given community. But the constitutional meaning of public use seems relatively straightforward to me. Now, the Institute for Justice clearly won the public relations battle arising from Kelo. And they did so by focusing on the painful impact on identifiable residential owners. And that really generates real emotion. And it's true that the compensation available generally will not compensate residential owners for their subjective harms. But in reality, many more individuals are harmed by eminent domain projects that all here would agree satisfy the public use standard. Highways, energy transmission corridors, sports stadiums, and indeed the absurd but performative exercise of constructing a wall along the southern border of the United States. Indeed, the poor and minorities invoked by Justice Thomas in his separate dissent have been and are being displaced as much or more by highway, port, and energy projects than by urban redevelopment. Because they tend to live in areas, if they're poor, they live in areas that are more likely to be blighted, or at least involve less expensive real estate, attractive to government planners trying to both improve the quality of the urban area and to bring in projects under budget. It's the compulsory aspect of eminent domain that is worrisome, not the sort of public goals that are sought to be achieved. And in the years since Kelo, the chief litigation focus regarding eminent domain has been on energy corridors, generally opposed on environmental grounds. Now, these problems are best addressed through robust public processes and transparency, allowing communities' opponents to make clear the costs of any specific eminent domain proposal, which then should get balanced in a transparent political process. Imposing a categorical exclusion for economic redevelopment is both over and under inclusive. It prevents possibly socially valuable projects like the Inner Harbor in Baltimore, and does not prevent disastrous projects like the Bruckner Expressway in New York City or the border wall itself. And I also support legislative measures to provide additional compensation above market value for homeowner residents and stipends for renters who typically receive no compensation when their homes are taken. And these additional payments should be available regardless of the public use for which the properties are taken. That seems to me to be the proper avenue for addressing eminent domain abuse, and it essentially requires a legislative solution. So that's enough for now. I look forward to the questions and comments.
Thank you, Peter. Last but not least is my colleague, Ilya Soman. He is a professor of law at the Antonin Scalia Law School, George Mason University. He's also the B. Kenneth Simon Chair in Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute. Ilya is the author or co-author of 5 books, and the one that's most relevant here is The Grasping Hand, Kelo and the City of New London and the Limits of Eminent Domain, 2015. Ilya.
Thank you so much. Like Peter, I also wrote an amicus brief in the case on behalf of the urban development theorist Jane Jacobs. Unlike Peter, I was obviously not successful in persuading the court, though they did cite my brief in a footnote. Nonetheless, the fact that both Jane Jacobs, who is way to the left of me, and I opposed these condemnations and wanted to see them struck down is a sign of how this issue cuts across ideological lines. Much has already been said about the facts of Kelo, so I've only briefly mention a few that weren't mentioned previously. Then I'll explain why Kelo was wrong from the standpoint of both originalism and at least some leading versions of living constitution theory. And I'll briefly talk about the massive political and judicial reaction that Kelo generated. So again, most of the facts of Kelo have already been given by previous speakers. I'll just note a couple additional relevant points. One is, as Eric said, the Supreme Court majority did indicate that they were deferring to what they called the carefully considered development plan by New London, but they also emphasized that they weren't going to, quote, second guess the quality of the plan. And indeed, that plan turned out to be atrocious, as was pointed out by the trial court judge and later by dissenters in the Connecticut Supreme Court. That plan was badly flawed from the start. It fell through. And indeed, for many years, to some extent, even up to the present day, nothing was actually built on the condemned property, and the only regular users of it were a colony of feral cats. And if you were going to build a home for feral cats, I think there should have been easier and less painful ways to achieve that objective, even if you consider that to be a public use, which it probably wasn't. But even if it was, there surely must have been better ways to achieve it. It is true that Kelo was prefigured by precedents, most notably Berman versus Parker in 1954, which I also believe was badly wrong. Indeed, it was a worse decision than Kelo. And in an article of mine, I've argued that it should be added to the anti-canon of constitutional law as one of the worst decisions in Supreme Court history, worse than Kelo in a number of ways that we can talk about in questions. And doctrinally, there was one good effect of chelo in that before it was thought that people like me who argued for a narrow definition of public use, either we were sort of wacko extremists or we were just ignorant of the state of the relevant legal precedent, because most experts thought, well, you know, Berman versus Parker and later the Midkiff case in 1984 settled this issue. After chelo, our position was suddenly part of the mainstream debate. Four Supreme Court justices were at least to a large extent on our side, so we couldn't be as easily dismissed as we were before. Nonetheless, I think it would have been better if chelo had gone the other way. And I think that's true from the standpoint of both originalism and living constitutionalism. As discussed in much more detail in my book, The Grasping Hand, if you look at 1791, when the Bill of Rights was enacted, we have only a limited amount of material on what they thought the meaning of public use was. But such as it is, it looks like it favors a narrow definition of public use under which a public use only exists if there's either government ownership of the condemned property, like with a road or a publicly owned building, or if it's owned by a common carrier or a utility, a private business that has a legal duty that's to serve the entire public. You see distinctions like this made by writers like Blackstone and Locke, who heavily influenced the founders. You see similar distinctions made in early court decisions on this issue and the like, and so on. Many originalists believe that when it comes to the application of the Bill of Rights against state and local governments, what matters is not the original meaning in 1791, but the original meaning in 1868, when the 14th Amendment made the Bill of Rights applicable to the states. And here we have a wealth of material showing that the narrow view of public use was predominant. It was the view held by a clear majority of state Supreme Courts at that time. It was held by treatise writers. And if your view of originalism is the understanding of the ordinary meaning of the text, like what would an ordinary person think, you know, the words public use means, it's pretty clear that both then and now, the ordinary meaning of public use is something like use by the public or ownership by the government. Indeed, when I teach chelo, even though I'm opposed to a decision, I have to spend most of my time explaining to students why anybody might agree with chelo, because the intuitive reaction of students, like most people I discuss this decision with, is like, well, it's obviously wrong. Obviously, this kind of thing is not a public use. And I have to explain, you know, well, there's precedent and there's various kinds of convoluted legal arguments that you can use. So to my own distaste, I have to do my duty as a teacher. I have to defend these sort of counterintuitive for most people conclusions to show people why, you know, respected jurists might think something like this. But that is itself an indication of where the ordinary meaning here actually was. In the book, I also go through a variety of living constitution theories and explain why also they go against chelo. Here, I'll just mention one, the idea of representation reinforcement, which is the court should especially try to protect the rights of people who can't fend for themselves in the political process. As has already been mentioned, economic development takings and blight condemnations and others that transfer property to private parties have historically been used against the poor, minorities, and the politically weak. To some degree, that's what happened in chelo itself. In the 50s, 60s, and 70s, the era of urban renewal takings, James Baldwin, the famous Black writer, said that urban renewal was really Negro removal because Blacks were so often targeted by it. In addition, if you think about it here, the situation here is even worse than other situations which are classically focused on by representation reinforcement theorists, because in those other situations, many of them, at least the victimized minority has the opportunity to vote at the ballot box against the politicians who did this to them. But here, if people are forced out of the community because their homes or their businesses are condemned by eminent domain, they're not even around at the next election to vote against you, to vote the bastards out, so to speak. So in some respects, it's even worse. There are also a number of problems with the chelo decision that cut across constitutional theories. One is a kind of double standard on deference. With no other enumerated provision of the Bill of Rights, do we have a rule where the courts are supposed to defer to the very entity that the rights are supposed to protect them against? But here with Berman and now chelo, we have a standard that so long as the government says there is a public use, there is a great deal of deference given to that unless, there is some kind of specific evidence that, the official rationale was a pretext for benefiting a private party, and what qualifies as a pretext is, to put it mildly, extremely unclear. This is much like saying we have a problem of, wolves stealing chickens from chicken coops. Who are going to appoint to determine what the rules for access to chicken coops are going to be? Well, let's have a committee of wolves do it. I'm going to defer to them. Obviously, your chickens are going to get stolen and eaten if you do that. And that's more or less what has happened here. In addition, in Justice Stevens' majority opinion, he cites what he calls a century of precedent supporting a broad view of public use. Justice Stevens, to his credit, after he retired from the Supreme Court, he admitted that this was wrong. And he even cited an article of mine, which, where I pointed this out. He said that it was, quote, an embarrassing to acknowledge error, because what he had actually done is he had taken late 19th and early 20th century precedents, which were not about the public use clause at all. They were about the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. And under those precedents, the courts had been relatively deferential to these kinds of takings for private use. That was in an era when the court had not really recognized that the public use clause in the Fifth Amendment generally applied to state and local governments. And therefore, if you wanted to challenge a state or local taking in federal court, you had to use the due process clause. There, I cannot think of another major Supreme Court decision where the author of the majority opinion actually later admitted that he made a major error in his analysis, though I do recognize he continued to believe that he got the bottom line right for reasons that we can talk about in questions if people are interested. Finally, a brief word on the legislative and judicial reaction to Kelo, as described more fully in my book and more recently in a piece I did for the Brennan Center website on the 20th anniversary 3 days ago. Some 45 states passed new legislation in response to Kelo, which is a record. No other Supreme Court decision has ever generated this much state legislation response, but about half or slightly more of the new laws are actually ineffective. They pretend to do reform, but actually don't. And of those that are effective, many make improvements, but perhaps don't fully solve the problem. So there's still a problem out there. Several state Supreme Courts have issued decisions repudiating Kelo as a guide to their state constitutional public use clauses. That's good, but certainly not all state Supreme Courts have done that. So there has been much progress since Kelo, but not enough. I think there is a real chance Kelo could someday be overruled. Four current Supreme Court justices have expressed interest in reconsidering it. However, I do have to admit that just a couple months ago, they turned down the Bowers case, which many of us, including me, thought would have been a great opportunity to revisit Kelo. Once again, I wrote an amicus brief, and once again, the justices didn't agree with me, or at least not enough to want to take the case. So we will have to see what happens with this in the future. And on that note, I conclude. And I very much look forward to the questions and discussion.
Thank you, Ilya. So we'll do a speed round now, and I'll just ask each of the panelists if they have any comments to add in response to what they heard from the other panelists. And I'll go in the same order that people spoke in. So, Wes?
Yes, just very briefly, I don't understand why Ilya and others of his ilk are so excited about private economic development plans as opposed to economic development plans in general. For example, this very plan, if it had been carried out by the city itself, assuming their competence to do so, rather than sending it out to a private party, it'd be the same plan. It'd be the same loss of people, of Mrs. Kelo's property. So I don't understand the focus on that. Why don't they focus, as Justice Kennedy was talking about, on is there a pretext here? And that applies to all sorts of them. I wrote an article 10 years ago saying, make the concurring opinion of Justice Kennedy a more muscular for all takings.
Thanks, Timothy.
Just briefly in response to that, I don't think that I am more outraged by Kelo because of its private nature. It's just that that's what Kelo is about. And of course, government shouldn't be in the business of economic development to begin with. Justice Stevens, in his opinion, says it's a traditional and longstanding function of government. And he provides no citation for that because, in fact, it's not. But the point that I thought was worth delving into is something Professor Byrne mentioned, which is the due process angle of Kelo, because properly understood, if we lived in a world where law were sane, Kelo would be seen as a due process case, because the prohibition on private takings is actually in the due process clause. Properly understood, that is pre-rational basis clause test, it's the due process clause that incorporates substantive prohibitions on what government can do. Today, this is sneered at as substantive due process, but it was always understood as the proper implementation of the due process clause until the progressive era, that not everything a legislature does qualifies as law. Arbitrary or egregiously unjust acts of the legislature might not be a law. They might be, as the Supreme Court put it in a 19th century case, a decree under legislative forms, and therefore not actually a law, and therefore it violates due process of law. And the quintessential example of that was a taking from A to give to B. That was the phrase that 19th century courts used all the time to characterize the quintessential abuse of democratic government, was for people to, by sheer dint of numbers at the voting booth or in the legislature or what have you, to use political power to enrich some at the expense of others. And this was considered the most dangerous threat of any democratic system of government. The reason you have a constitution is essentially to protect people against that from happening, to ensure that both procedural and substantive limitations apply to the government to prevent the redistribution of wealth through government power. And that's why Kelo, as I mentioned, Kelo is such a perfect symbol, because it really encapsulates all of the ways that these political philosophical disagreements, where the rubber really meets the road there. But when people look at the Constitution, they say, well, where is the express prohibition on private takings, which some state constitutions, including Arizona, do have? You don't find it in the Fifth Amendment, because it's the Due Process Clause that's supposed to be doing that job. But thanks to the rational basis test, it fails to do so.
Thank you, Timothy. Peter.
Well, I'm shocked to find myself agreeing with Tim about the prominence of the Due Process Clause. I think we disagree substantially on its scope, but not really on the fact that the limitations here really are, what are the legitimate functions of government? And the Due Process Clause is our sort of rule of law foundation for what that is. The phrase, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation, taking for public use doesn't necessarily create a legal standard. It's a description of what public expropriation is. It's the taking of private property for public use. And so the question about the validity of that is really a question about the validity of what the government is doing in a broader sense. And I believe that the government has a role, must have a role in a democratic society, to take actions that impinge upon people's interests in order to build a stronger society for all people. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't make mistakes. Private people make mistakes. The public makes mistakes. But the focus really here should be on the Due Process Clause. And as I said in my first remarks, I do think that Kelo is an improvement on Berman, in the sense that the Stevens and the Kennedy opinions together create a kind of intermediate scrutiny to determine. And indeed, I think the dissent in the Connecticut Supreme Court, in which the justices emphasized that the planners didn't have a real notion of what the hell they were going to do with Ms. Kelo's property, meant that it was not really essential for the government process, and therefore was invalid under what I understand to be the state constitution. So, I'm comfortable with that, but we're knocking on a bigger argument about the scope of what's appropriate for government to do in regards to the market.
Thank you, Peter. Ilya.
So just briefly, 3 points. First, Wes brought up, well, what about, you know, federalism and the autonomy of the states? In my book and other writings, I respond to that by pointing out, if you want local control, the ultimate in local control when it comes to property is letting each property owner determine for him or herself how their land is going to be used. This is true in the area of eminent domain. It's also true in the area of zoning, where I write about it. So YIMBYism, yes, in my backyard, is the ultimate localism. If you like local control, you should support my position on this set of issues, both with respect to public use and eminent domain, and also with respect to zoning and other property rights issues. It doesn't get much more local than letting people decide what can be built on their own land. That's good from a moral point of view and a constitutional point of view. It's also good from the standpoint of economic growth and efficiency, because secure property rights are essential to that. So if we really want economic development, we should protect people's property rights rather than take it away. Then maybe more than just feral cats will benefit from our policies. Secondly, both Peter and Wes reasonably raised the issue of, well, what about, you know, problems caused by narrow public use takings, you know, like, you know, takings for infrastructure and the like. And my answer is sort of twofold. One is that we don't have an ideal constitution. If we did, and if I got to write the property rights provision of the constitution, I would put some severe constraints on narrow public use takings too, more severe than the ones that currently exist. Unfortunately, they didn't consult me in 1791 or in 1868. So I want to, at the very least, eliminate this category of harmful takings and use the constitution we have to do that, even if you know, we don't have an ideal constitution that fully eliminates eminent domain abuse. That said, it is also the case that in some cases, there is a better justification for narrow public use takings than for this, you know, vastly broad definition of public use that the Supreme Court has given us, in that when we are engaging in property acquisition for private development, private developers have many good ways to get around possible holdouts, including just simply not announcing that they're doing a big development project. They can use what is known as secret assembly. With public projects, we don't want them to be done in secret. There needs to be public debate about them. And also, the government is really bad at keeping secrets, even more important secrets than, like, you know, building project secrets. And so there's an important distinction there. Finally, I think Peter and Tim suggest, well, maybe some of this should be done under the due process clause. Maybe there should be a stronger due process clause, but public use is not just descriptive. It is a constraint on the types of takings that should be imposed. We know that from 200 years of history. Nobody at the founding or in 1868 said that, you know, public use is just descriptive. And if you adopt this other kind of approach, you end up with a situation where, you know, takings for private use not only are permissible, but they don't even require compensation at all, which is an absurdity and is not, I think, in accordance with the text, original meaning, or good living constitution theory either. Okay.
Thank you, Ilya. We have time maybe for about 8 minutes. So I hope 3 questions. So one questioner put really a statement in the chat. I'll turn it into a question. So the statement is, in 2002, the DC Council passed a special bill to take the Skyland Shopping Center, no finding of blight, much litigation and millions of dollars spent on this. Small business owners at Skyland lost their businesses. I guess the questions are, does Kelo stop that, or do the limits on the Kelo holding provide ways to stop the Skyland taking? I don't know anything myself about that, so I'm wondering if any of the other panelists do.
So I don't remember all the details about that particular taking, but I think it would turn on whether the taking is pretextual. And as I noted earlier, while both the majority and concurring opinions in Kelo say that so-called pretextual takings are violations of the public use clause, they are extremely unclear on what exactly qualifies a pretextual taking. In my writings, I have identified 5 different approaches to what qualifies the pretextual taking. The lower courts have identified or have adopted since Kelo. The Supreme Court has never yet taken a case to try to tell us which of those 5 approaches is correct. This is actually one of the reasons why Kelo needs to be revisited, even if it's not going to be overturned completely, as I think it should be. We still need clarity on, you know, exactly what counts as a pretextual taking.
Skyline case, I have a brief, some memory of it, and it was an effort by the part of the D.C. government to get a supermarket in a part of the city, part of the district that was considered a food desert, had no supermarket. And so there was, the plan was, I think the mayor thought she could get a supermarket in that Skyland Center, needed the space. And then it became a total disaster because the supermarket pulled out of the deal. And so it actually raises interesting questions about what's, you know, the role of the private party, like the supermarket, in an eminent domain project, which plainly had a public purpose, which was to put a supermarket in a neighborhood, in a part of the city which had no access to fresh food.
I would add to that, Eric, you know, from a practitioner's angle, we keep throwing around the word blight as if this word means something. And in fact, the word blight really basically means whatever the government says it means. Blight is, originally it was a term for a plant disease. The progressive era started applying this word to the economy with the implication that the government is a gardener that goes in and prunes and adjusts the garden of your life and my life in order to make it what the government thinks is appropriate. And the term blight took off from there. Blight is defined by state law, and most state laws use remarkably vague definitions. California, which is the one I'm most familiar with, defines blight by, there's two lists of factors. And the city or the local government can declare area blighted if it has one item from each of these lists. And each of these lists is worded so broadly that basically anything can qualify as blight. My favorite one is factors that substantially hinder the economically viable use of buildings. Well, of course, the very existence of a building on a site will hinder the economically viable use of a building, because you could tear it down and build a better building there, right? So things like the lack of shade or sunlight will qualify as a factor in the blight analysis. You only need one of these things from each of the lists. So and then in order to define these factors, what happens is local governments hire consultants. And what the consultant does is he engages in what's called a windshield survey, which is exactly what it sounds like. The consultant drives through the neighborhood and then goes back to the office and writes up a report and says, boy, it's full of ugly buildings. You know, there's some paint that's kind of faded in the sunlight. There's a street light that doesn't work. And therefore it's blighted, right? And once that's blighted, the government or the court is supposed to defer to that. And so blight basically is where all the dice are loaded against the property owner. It means whatever the politicians say it means. And then courts defer to that and call it a public use as if this is some sort of well-considered, you know, brilliant Soviet five-year plan for economic development. And it turns out just as well as Soviet five-year plans always did.
Tim, you've got to give credit, though, to New London. They never claimed blight.
That is true. They never even claimed that it was blighted. By the way, is one reason why the IJ and others thought that it was a different case than Berman. Is because in Kelo and in a few other cases, by the way, around the same time, I remember there was a case in California called 99 Cent Stores where the local government said, well, the property is not blighted now, but it will be someday, and declared it future blight was the theory they used to condemn the property. All right. That's why there was a distinction between those two cases.
Hey, thanks for the thoughts on the answer, to answer that question. We'll do one more. So in the news, there's been news reports about a plan in Cranberry, New Jersey, to seize a 21-acre farm that's been in a family for 175 years and build affordable housing on it. So that's the statement in the question. I guess the question is, how would should that be a taking for public use? How would the Kelo decision apply to the Cranberry proposal?
So I think under Kelo, that proposal would almost certainly go through unless it could be proven to somehow be pretextual. On the other hand, it might not go through under the New Jersey state constitution, which has been interpreted by New Jersey courts to be considerably more restrictive than the federal constitution's interpretation of Kelo. I would add that if you're interested in affordable housing, the way to do that is not to condemn people's property and force its building, but rather to do what I advocate in various of my writings, including my recent article, The Constitutional Case case against exclusionary zoning, which is to simply say that exclusionary zoning itself is a kind of taking because it severely restricts what people can do with their property, and therefore the government cannot do it unless they pay compensation, which as a practical matter would mean they cannot do it over vast sweeping areas. In most places, including in New Jersey, the big obstacle to affordable housing is that the government simply doesn't allow very much of it to be built. And then they try to make up for it by saying, we're going to like set aside certain properties where it is built. And we're going to like force you to do it. I say, you know, stop the coercion on both ends, stop the exclusionary zoning, which prevents the construction initially. And then you won't need so-called inclusionary zoning laws, which evidence suggests that, you know, they actually deter as much building of affordable housing as they create.
I'd be happy to participate in another Federal Society forum on affordable housing. But it does seem odd to me to think that the way to do this is to condemn a cranberry bog to put affordable housing apparently out in the middle of other cranberry bogs.
Yeah. Delos, the ideas that Ilya has here about exclusionary zoning, I think it's great.
Okay, Edie, with that, we're a minute before the close of time. And if we
ended on agreement, how about that?
Yeah, with agreement. So that's a good place to stop. Let's quit while we're ahead and agreeing.
Yeah, on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to you all for speaking, Peter, Ilya, Timothy, and Wes. And thank you, Eric, for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise today. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.